You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Now back to more of Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:06 right now. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on the Civic Media Network. We hope that you are having a great start to your day. Some beautiful weather across Wisconsin, or at least what we're hoping is going to be some beautiful weather. Great start with a lot of sunshine in downtown Madison. And hey, by the way, if you're listening on 93.5 The Tap in Eau Claire, or on WRCE in Richland Center, or WLCX in La Crosse, we are super glad that you're here. And I do want to say, too, I'm very excited for this hour. We want you to stick with us because we're going to have local author Brian Reisinger, who's going to join us. We're going to talk about the farming industry and how these trade policies have affected farming in the state of Wisconsin, and what that looks like going forward for our farming families, Brian. So I'm very excited to have that conversation.
Yeah, we've both talked to Brian before, and this will be very interesting because there's two schools of thoughts coming from farmers. There's a lot to talk about, but first, can we please turn our attention?
I'm very excited to have this conversation today.
I am too. And listen, I'm gonna spoiler alert. If you're a Kristi Noem fan, probably not the segment for you, because Kristi Noem yesterday faced a lot of very tough, is an understatement, questioning from Democrats and Republicans. There was a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. The senators questioned her on a number of things, not least of them the deaths of two American citizens in Minneapolis, shot by ICE officers, administrative warrants, the advertising spending. Oh, the ubiquitous Kristi Noem.
This runway is your future. Shut up.
Her use of jets. They didn't bring up the alleged jet trysts in the Mile High Club between Kristi and Corey.
Do we want our legislatures really dabbling in that? I feel like they have their own interests there probably their own story. So we're going to let
We had a lot of, I'm going to use two words, blue dress, all right? That's all I'm going to say.
There we go.
But it did not go well for Kristi. And of course, the usual suspects went after her, Democratic senators. Mm-hmm. But to me, Jamie, the Republican senators, that was the story of the day.
It was the story of the day, and we're going to get there. But I think one of the big moments from the Democrats is when Noem actually defended her early comments about the death of Alex Pretty, who we know was shot and killed by our own eyes and all the video that is circulated by the DHS officers. Now, she said she did not call him a domestic terrorist and said that his actions appeared to be domestic. His actions appeared, I got to stress that a little bit more, to be domestic terrorism. This was the exchange that she had with Senator Klobuchar, obviously of Minnesota, so a little bit more closer to home on this one yesterday. This is Cut 6, please.
After the killings of Renee Good and Alex Pretty, when I spoke to Alex's parents, they told me that you calling him a domestic terrorist, this was directly from them, the day after he was killed. A nurse in our VA, Alex, one of the most hurtful things they could ever imagine was said by you about their son. Do you have anything you want to say to Alex Pretty's parents?
We were relying in the hours after that incident that was so horrific on information we were getting from the ground from our agents.
I just asked if you had anything you wanted to say to the parents or to the family of Renee Good after you called them domestic terrorists.
I can't even imagine what they have gone through in the loss of their son and the loss of their family members.
But how about specifically calling them domestic terrorists without any evidence of that?
Sir, I did not call him a domestic terrorist. I said it appeared to be an incident of.
Okay, so that was what she said to Senator Klobuchar yesterday under oath in a hearing, okay? Mm-hmm. So let's go back to January 24th and hear what Kristi Noem had to say about Alex Pretty. This is Cut 7.
When you perpetuate violence against a government because of ideological reasons and for reasons to resist and perpetuate violence, that is the definition of domestic terrorism. This individual who came with weapons and ammunition to stop a law enforcement operation of federal law enforcement officers committed an act of domestic terrorism. That's the facts.
kind of sounds like mental gymnastics in order to not say what you actually said or to cover up what you actually said in front of the press for all of us to hear the day that Alex Pretty was shot and killed.
And we're not falling for it.
No.
Christy, we know you said what you said. We got it. This person came to commit an act of domestic terrorism is the same thing as saying they are a domestic terrorist. It is unbelievable. And she's sitting there in front of they love human props.
Mm.
She had a bunch of families whose children had been killed by undocumented immigrants behind her. They're holding the picture. So she kept using that. But yes, this goes back. Everything is a lie. And they are so, I don't know if they're willfully ignorant or if they're really that stupid to think we have you on tape. You said what you said. We can hear it. We can see it. We are not, these aren't the days where there was no record of things. We know everything you've said.
I think they're hoping we forget. I think they're hoping that they throw so much at us at so quickly and so often that our memories are short and we forget. But
yeah,
we are
but
not
no matter-
forgetting.
Like you and I might forget, but there's millions of people who love digging up every old tweet or old, and that's only this was only January.
Yeah.
So it really
it's still pretty
we can
fresh.
All remember a month ago.
Yeah, it's still pretty fresh. I mean, it feels like it was an eternity ago based on everything that's happened since that January 24th press conference, but it literally wasn't that long ago. Now, video released later contradicted Noam's claims, too, that Pretty had brandished at a firearm before he was actually shot. She also declined to retract comments about Renee Good in yesterday's hearing, which, of course, we know is another person killed by DHS officers in the Twin Cities. Democratic senators pressed her to admit mistakes in the department's early descriptions of the incidents. She did say that officials were relying on reports from agents at the scene. It's always about deflection, too, with this administration. They won't take responsibility or accountability.
Please.
Always deflect.
And that comes up later because that was even the Republican senators, and we're getting
yes.
to them because that's the highlight.
Yes.
We're burying the lead. But they also were like, you never take responsibility. There is never you never can admit that something went wrong. And when Republicans are telling you that,
You
may want to listen.
So we're going to jump in with Senator John Kennedy now, because let's be realistic. On most issues, I have been in fierce opposition to most of what John Kennedy has said publicly, has said on the record, has said in hearings. Yesterday during the testimony, he questioned a $220 million, I'm dropping my pen here, $220 million DHS advertising campaign. And he said that the ads prominently feature Noam and questioned how the contracts were awarded. This is hearing gold. If you were a political nerd, this is hearing gold coming from John Kennedy especially. This is cut 7.
The president approved ahead of time you spending $220 million running TV ads across the country in which you are featured prominently.
Yes, sir. We went through the legal processes, did it correctly.
Did the president know you were going to do this?
Yes.
He did?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
And one thing, Senator, I think would be helpful to know is how effective that communications has been. That overwhelmingly
effective in your name recognition. I personally just... I mean, to me, it puts the president in a terribly awkward spot, and I'm not saying you're not telling the truth. It's just hard for me to believe, knowing the president, as I do, that you said, Mr. President, here's some ads I've cut, and I'm going to spend $220 million running them, that he would have agreed to that. I don't think Russ Vogt at OMB would have agreed to that. It's something we have to defend. I'm on the Appropriations Committee. My research shows that you did not bid them out, that you pick, in fact, one of the people you picked, the strategy group, I'm sorry, Safe America Media was a company formed 11 days before
Oops.
You picked them, and that the strategy group got most of the money, and the head of that is married to your former spokesperson. Look, we all have friends who are qualified. I'm not quibbling with that. It troubles me. A fifth to a quarter of $1 billion of taxpayer money when we're scratching for every penny and we're fighting over rescission packages.
Oops. Yeah, a company that was formed 11 days before. That's just long enough for the ink to dry and the paperwork to go through. They're like, we can't award the contract today, not today. Here it is. Here, this company is great.
What I thought was most interesting about that is why Senator Kennedy was asking her these questions. He was trying so hard to give her an off-ramp at the same time.
Yep.
It was literally like he was leading her to say the right answer that he wanted to hear to settle it in his own mind as a supporter of this administration, and he couldn't do it. He couldn't get her there to be able to say those words, and she obviously did not understand where things were going because she was not taking the off-ramp that was being offered. Now, the conversation got really tense when Senator Tom Tillis, the Republican from North Carolina, started criticizing Noem's leadership, accusing her of DHS poorly handling deportations and arresting innocent Americans. He also criticized Noem's refusal to acknowledge mistakes in those Minneapolis shootings. This is where it got really heated, though, because he called out Noem to resign yesterday. Tillis was a man who voted to confirm her. He asked her to resign yesterday and even went as far as referencing her memoir about killing her family dog and her family goat. This is Cut 8.
Secretary, I read your book last week. And honestly, some of the parts of it impress me, but some of it distresses me. And I'll give you a good example of one that does. The passage where you talk about killing a dog that was 14 months old. I train dogs, all right? And you are a farmer. You should know better. You should know that if you're going out to a hunting lodge and you're putting pheasants out and you're putting dogs out, you don't take a puppy out there. A 14-month-old dog is basically a teenager in dog years. You decided to kill that dog because you had not invested the appropriate time in training, and then you have the audacity to go into a book and say it's a leadership lesson about tough choices. It's in your book. We could play it if we had time. At that same lunch hour, you killed a goat. And you killed the goat because you said it was behaving badly. You are a farmer. You don't castrate a goat. They behave badly. You should have probably done that before. But my point is, those are bad decisions made in the heat of the moment, not unlike what happened up in Minneapolis. We're an exceptional nation. And one of the reasons we're exceptional is we expect exceptional leadership. And you've demonstrated anything but that in the time that I've seen you responding to the emergency in North Carolina and across the Southeast and acknowledging when mistakes are made and speaking too soon for the expedient of social media or whatever it is.
Wow.
He was apoplectic. He had charts, graphs. Yeah. He went on and on. We could play. We could have played the whole thing because his commentary against her was unleashed.
He
went
the facts.
Crazy. I liked it.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, time is the tyrant. But I don't know if you know. We'll talk about Trump and the lawsuits against law firms and what he's doing and how they backtracked again on Daybreak.
This is the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
All facts, no fiction. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:22 right now. You are listening to Daybreak, as the big voice guy just said. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. We're glad you're with us. We've talked a lot about media companies who've capitulated to the administration and tech companies that are capitulating. And if you remember, a year ago, Donald Trump started a campaign against, he signed an executive order where he was going to target the some of the biggest, the most premier law firms in this country because he didn't like that they had been part of the investigations into him. He didn't like what they did. He didn't like what they said. It was nothing unethical. They had done nothing wrong, but the president just wanted them to, you know, go out of business unless they paid him a little cash. Well, earlier this week, they decided, all right, we're going to drop those suits. We're going to forget it. Well, as is the case in a lot of areas with this administration, on Monday, they abandoned the efforts to enforce those orders. And on Tuesday, they decided, nope, we're going back. The administration abruptly reversed course yesterday, said it would proceed with the court fight against these. They can't explain, much like the war, why there was this change of plan, but there is. And so now the law firms, some of them immediately gave in and paid off. It was a huge amount of free legal service. That was the price they had to pay to stay in business and stay on the good side of the administration. Some paid it right away. Some are still vowing that we are not going to give in. We're not going to fight. But it's,
yeah,
again, just extortion against people who were only doing their job and not the old follow. We were only following orders defense. This is, hey, we were hired. We're attorneys. We were investigating these allegations and these cases. And what do you want us to do?
You know, and I think that's the amazing part, because this isn't just about the attorneys and these law firms necessarily. It's about how power is being used right now and how stable government decisions are. Because when you first look at this, the Justice Department said that it was going to drop that appeal. They lost in court. Sounded like the administration was going to back down. And then they reversed course and said that they're going to continue this fight. So now we sit here talking about this story thinking, was this actually a win for the law firms? Was it just a pause before the next move? And then there's this sense that something else is probably going to come from this administration, right? Like, is there going to be a new order? Is there going to be some new legal argument? Is there a new strategy? Because their executive orders for this administration are not just symbolic. They are literally aimed usually at some sort of punishment. In this case, it's going to be to punish law firms by suspending their security clearances, maybe canceling federal contracts, maybe blocking lawyers from federal buildings because of the past legal work in it connected to Trump investigations. We've got Dave chiming in over on the text line this morning saying, what amazes me is how many people believe the mega BS. If you want to chime in on the conversation, text in, call in. We'd love to hear from you today. 1-855-752-4842. That's 1-855-75-CIVIC.
We have to point out, too, that just like the investigation into the alleged interference in the 2020 election, all of the challenges to these executive orders have been upheld by judges. Mm-hmm. They all ruled that these were not legal. They didn't hold water, and so the law firms were winning. Well, that cannot make this administration happy because they're so used to, despite Donald Trump's protestations that we should be tired of winning, man, you would think he and his administration would be tired of losing every court battle they come up against, from the Supreme Court all the way down on every issue.
Don't you think, though, it's about limiting the independence of the legal system? Because we know that we know, as logical human beings, that lawyers are supposed to be able to represent clients, even the most unpopular ones, even the ones who are guilty, without fear of government retaliation. That's a basic part of how the justice system actually works. So when the government starts targeting these law firms for doing the real work that it doesn't actually like, or just, you know, doesn't want them to be a part of, the courts are going to tend to take that very seriously. And then we see this back and forth that we're having now, making us wonder, what is the real plan? What is this actually about? Is the administration going to test their limits on executive power? Are they trying to really dive deep into these intimidation tactics, or is this just a refusal to back down? It's exhausting. It's exhausting having to constantly wonder what the motive is. Why? Because we used to have a boring government where these questions didn't matter. We just went about our daily lives and things happened and people did their jobs and government employees made sure that the system kept moving along. And now we have to constantly ask these questions.
Well, and the scandals came one at a time. Let's, you know, there'd be a scandal and we could all focus on that one thing and then it would get resolved one way or another, or it would go away and then we'd be quiet for a little bit and something else would pop up. There's always something, but this is a nonstop barrage of everything's a crisis. And I know that the Republican side of the aisle wants to make it seem like everything is not a crisis. But a lot of it is, and this is not hysteria. This is not Trump derangement syndrome. This is people looking at the facts and going, okay, you keep bringing these threats against these law firms. The judges have said your appeal to them not following it is not legal.
Yeah.
Should be it, right? That should be the end of it. This should go away, and then something else will come along. But no, this will stay on the burner, too, because— everything is being thrown at the wall to distract.
They want that sort of uncertainty. They want us to be exhausted, because when we're actually exhausted, then we start questioning what the laws are and what the system itself is doing. So they want us to be exhausted because they want us to not be paying attention so that we start questioning our norms so that they can start breaking them down, or at least in this case, continue to break them down.
When we come back.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
You got to tease, Jamie. This is radio. Brian Rusker is going to join us. He's the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor. We're going to talk about the effect of the tariffs and the state of Wisconsin's family farms on the other side. Now you can do it.
Now I can do it. This is Daybreak, 829. You're listening to the Civic Media Network.
Local news, community stories, and the conversations that matter most. Now, more Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
It's 8:35 right now. Good morning. If you are just joining us on the Civic Media Network, we are glad that you are with us on this Wednesday. My name is Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Here in Wisconsin and across the country, over the past year, Trump's tariffs have caused major uncertainty with farmers. The Supreme Court decision that struck down those tariffs hasn't done a lot yet to eliminate those concerns and that uncertainty. Meanwhile, farm bankruptcies here in Wisconsin increased 700% in 2025. 16 farms filed for bankruptcy in 2025 versus two in 2024. Joining us to talk about the state of family farms in Wisconsin is Brian Reisinger. You may know him as the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope and the Untold Story of the Disappearing American Farmer. Brian, it's good to talk to you again. I spoke to you when the book first came out, and Jamie has spoken to you since. It's good to be back, but we know your story. For the people who might, can you give us a brief history of your family farm and its connection to Wisconsin?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for having me here. We've been around for four generations. My dad is still farming. My sister's working to take the farm over. And we really began in 1912 when my great-grandparents escaped pre-World War I Europe, came to Wisconsin to dig a better living out of the dirt, like so many people all across the state. And since then, our family has lived through the generations, through the Depression, through the farm crisis, through globalization, everything. And along the way, for any farm family, there's weather that blesses and threatens, there's economic upheaval, there's farm accidents. So we decided to tell that story honestly in our book, but weave that with the forces that are wiping out family farms across the country. And so that's what brings us here today, is this is a crisis that everybody in the state of Wisconsin and rural communities is living. And we decided it was time to tell the story.
Yeah. Now, it's a great book. I do implore anybody who wants a little history and to find out about what the farming community is like to take a read. You can find that at brian-reisinger.com. Now, Brian, you mentioned that we've seen a 700% increase in farm bankruptcies in Wisconsin in just the last year alone. You know, for somebody who is a rural policy expert and who lives on a farm part-time and works within the farming community, what are you hearing from farmers across the state right now? Is this as serious as these facts make it sound right now?
Well, you know, it is really challenging. It's very serious. And I think that the farm families that are out there, whatever their view is of one piece of news or one direction in politics or another, it's a continuation of something that people have been living for decades. And I think that's the thing I always try to tell people whenever we hear like the national media swooping in saying, hey, farmers are in crisis. Farmers are kind of like, hey, we've been in crisis here. What are we going to do about this in a big picture way? So it's true that some of the recent events have been challenging. And it's also true that those recent events are attached to deep, deep issues. We've had economic crises from the Great Depression to COVID and beyond that our country didn't understand the impact of. We've had governmental policies from both parties for decades. We've had technology that's moved American agriculture forward, but also leaves so many of our family farmers behind. These are some of those foundational things that are going on, driving economic decline, whatever's happening in the news. And then when you see something dramatic that's happening to farmers, that adds on top of it. So that's really the reality that our farm families are living.
Brian, for people who are not in the agriculture industry, we don't, you know, we know what farms are, we know what farmers do, but we hear different things regarding the tariffs and other policies. Some farmers are saying, no, these are horrible things. They're really hurting us. We're paying more for fertilizer. We're paying more for this and that. But then there are other farmers who are saying, yeah, things are rough, but it's leveling the playing field as far as trade. Is there a truth on one side or the other? Is it in the middle? What is the actual impact for Wisconsin farmers?
I'm so glad you asked that because there's so many people making, you know, political arguments one direction or another. And here's the reality. And this is why you hear things from farmers like that. Farmers live in a state of double-edged sword as it pertains to trade. So it is true that when you have trade disputes that spin out of control, you know, retaliatory tariffs from other countries, meaning they're not going to buy our goods, are going to make it more expensive to sell soybeans in China, for instance, and nobody in China is going to be buying soybeans in America. That's really challenging. We saw that last fall. At the same time, the other swing of that double-edged blade is the fact that farm families have been living with unfair trade practices since the 90s. And this is something that both parties have talked about. There were a lot of labor Democrats who talked about this back in the day too. And the reality is that you have great big trading partners like China that will buy up, whether it's dairy or whether it's corn or soybeans, they'll buy it up until they have American farmers hostage. And then they'll dump those products to drive the prices down. So we've got unfair trade keeping prices down. We've also got trade disputes if they spin out of control causing problems. So what you have, not all farmers agree, and I don't speak for all of them, but we have is a lot of farmers saying, boy, we do need to get tough. We do need to do something to make sure that trade across the globe is fair to our farmers. At the same time, they say, hey, we got to make sure that these negotiations reach a result and that we don't end up just having disputes that make people not willing to deal with it and shut markets down. So it's those two things at once. That's what happens in the real world.
So we're talking with Brian Reisinger. He's the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor. He is a writer. He's a rural policy expert. If you want to check out the book or more on him, go to brian-reisinger.com. So when you talk a little bit about all of these trade disputes, and you and I have had this conversation, I feel like there are certain subsects of the world that are used as pawns for each political party. And I feel like farmers are very much in part of that game. How do we get through to our legislators? What can we be telling them? What can the farming community or anybody who just is worried about the family farm, because they are such a backbone of our community, what can we be imploring to our legislators right now?
You know, I always tell people, if you want to see a politician's arm shoot up fast, ask them if they've ever voted to support a farmer, you know, because everybody's got some kind of program or something one way or the other in both parties they voted for, of course, to support the farmer. They're going to say that. The reality is that we need to go a layer deeper. And what I always say to people, and this was born out of research in the book, when I was seeing all the dilemmas where we had false choices, made the wrong choice in our history, and I got the chance to tie that with my family's story and what so many farm families have lived through, what I always say is, hey, ask your leaders what they're doing to create new entrepreneurial opportunity for our farmers, because that's harder. They have to stop and think about that. And if they don't know, well, what could I do to create new opportunity for our farmers? Talk about how you want to buy your food. Talk about what you want out of your food. You know, where you want to get, you know, local or regional or specialty foods. Like, talk to them about how you want things to be different and how you could connect that with farmers down the road if only our food system was different. That challenges them to do something to change the situation, find ways for food to get from the farm gate to the dinner table more ways. Because right now, with us wiping out farms at 45,000 a year on average for the past century, we're making it harder and harder for farmers to grow food and harder for that food to get from the farm gate to the dinner table. It's jacking up food prices. It's making things less healthy. It's making it harder to find local food sources, all these problems.
See, you say those numbers and you're used to hearing those numbers, but yeah. People outside of the industry, those numbers are shocking. And yeah. I'm sure there are other things on a day-to-day basis for a family farm like yours, from how much is ice having an effect on costs? And what are the other kind of things that day-to-day you're dealing with? Because it's everybody can understand, oh, fertilizer costs more, seed costs more. Okay, that's the same as if we go to the grocery store, things cost more. Yeah. But there's a lot of other factors at play on the day-to-day. And what are some of those for the people who, you know, we care, but we just don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when my dad goes into the fields planting this spring, and when my sister who's working to take over the farm joins him, when they're doing that, and when all of us are working to figure out where we're going to go with our farm in the future, what we're dealing with is the fact that there are very few new and growing markets for farmers out there. Most farmers are, you know, facing the fact that they've got markets available to them that for one reason or another have kind of become broken. You know, you got corn, field corn. The price of corn in the past year was about $4. That's not too far off from where it was when I was born in 1984, when I was a kid. Meantime, the seed, the feed, the fertilizer, the energy, all those costs continue to go up. Now, you mentioned ice and other things. When you talk about things like, you know, farm labor, half our farm labor comes from immigrant labor. What we need is Washington not only to find a way to change our food system, find a way to, you know, secure the border, which has been a bipartisan goal for a long time and many farmers support, while also increasing access to legal farm labor. I mean, the H-2A farm visa program is there for people who want to come to this country and work hard and find a way up. And we do need that agricultural labor. Our farm has never had immigrant labor, but there are farms that aren't too much bigger than ours down the road who have. And so the reality is you got all these increasing costs and all these huge disruptions going on where farmers are kind of caught in the crosshairs of all of our political crosswinds here. And while that's going on, they don't have new and growing markets. What we need is more and more places that farmers could say, hey, I could sell this over here. I could sell that over there. There's very little of that available to our farmers these days.
Brian, we also hear right now that there are some of these farmers who are having harder times getting the operating loans that they might depend on each and every season. So why are lenders starting to view farming and the farms in general as a bigger risk?
Yeah, well, one of the issues that we've got is that farming has continued to go toward this tipping point. We're just getting tougher and tougher to point to farming and say, hey, this is something that I can invest in. Now, I think that's actually a misnomer. I think people are mistaken about that. The reality is that people care more than ever about where their food comes from. And there are a lot of hardworking, resilient farm families making it through all of this, you know, even though our country does so many things to make the economics not work. But one of the big things that we can do, a lever we can pull in order to make getting operating loans easier, is to pass a bipartisan farm bill. And they're actually debating that this week. The farm bill is supposed to be passed for 5 years ahead. So you pass the farm bill and it sets things for 5 years. And whether people like the government programs or not, there's debates about that. Those programs set all kinds of pricing mechanisms and different things in the industry. So you can want more government or less government, whatever you want. Passing that bipartisan farm bill is crucial to setting up all these programs and letting people know what the industry is going to be like. So bankers who are out there, they need to see a farm bill in order to be able to lend. So not having one makes it harder, even for private sector sources of capital, bankers and credit unions and others, to lend to a farmer.
You mentioned the number of family farms that go under every year. And we've talked about the financing and all of that. How are the big corporate farms being affected? That would seem like they're safer, and, you know, people like you guys and your smaller farm are really the ones who are in danger. There's always going to be somebody growing the food because we need to eat it. But are the family farms in exponentially more danger?
Yeah. You know, what's happening overall is that all farms, large, small, whatever shape and size, are all subject to this overall force of get big or get out. All these problems we've been talking about, what the one thing all these problems have in common is they all push farms toward get big or get out. So the great big farms are getting bigger and bigger because they have to be able to make it economically, and they gobble up other farms. The medium and small size farms are either getting bigger as well or slipping by the wayside. There are some who are being creative, diversifying, finding ways to make it, but it is very, very hard. So that's what's going on. And family farms, you're right. As a result, those midsize and small farms are getting in worse and worse shape. Here's the reality. We will always have someone growing our food, but if we keep losing farms at this rate, 45,000 a year going forward, like we have for the past century, 45,000 a year, I'm 41. By the time my little baby girl is my age, we'll have lost the rest of our family farms in this country. So we'll have a food system that is too big to fail. If you think about that, imagine what happened when the banks are too big to fail. People worried, is the ATM going to kick out money to me? Then they're going to have to wonder, is the store or the restaurant going to have food for me? If we have such big systems and part of it collapses, that's a huge problem.
And Brian, we have about a minute left. If we continue losing these farms, the small, the mid-sized farms at the rate that we're talking, what does this mean for rural communities across states like Wisconsin? And what is the future of agriculture in general?
Yeah, well, all Americans in that scenario are going to see food prices continue to get higher and food less healthy. For farm families in rural communities, here's what happens. Farming is the backbone of a lot of rural communities, even places that have transitioned toward other things. They still have roots so deep in agriculture that when you keep losing your farms, you harm your rural communities. There's fewer businesses in downtown Main Street. There's fewer banks. There's fewer everything. And so it really does hollow out our rural communities. Now, I have optimism because 96% of our farms are still family farms. That means there's nearly 2 million farm families out there still fighting to make it. And we try to tell those resilient stories too.
Well, Brian, we always enjoy talking to you. Brian Reisiger is our guest. He is the author of Land Rich, Cash Poor, My Family's Hope, and The Untold History of the Disappearing American Farmer. You can get it anywhere books are sold or go to brian-reisinger.com. Brian, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Well, thanks for sharing my name.
It's 8:48 right now. You're listening to the Civic Media Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Local voices, statewide impact. It's Daybreak with Brian and Jamie.
8:52 right now. We hope that you are having a great morning. I am Jamie Martinson.
And I'm Brian Noonan. Glad you're here. We had some texts coming in. We've been talking about how Wisconsin is going to be affected by rising gas prices based on what's going on in Iran and the Straits of Hormuz, and all of that. So people have been chiming in. You can always chime in, 855-75-CIVIC, 855-752-4842. And we do get around to them.
We do.
We have a lot to say. Right away.
We have a lot to say. Tom from Hartford, thank you for the text. Listening on WMDX this morning, says that he hasn't seen any gas less than $2.90 a gallon as of yesterday. Roger in Stevens Point saying it was $3.09 in Stevens Point and Marshfield in his travels yesterday. Tiffany over in River Falls, listening on 93.5 The Tap, says that in her area it's about $3.19 right now. Nice. And she also chimed in to give us a little credit on having Brian Reisinger on, saying that she just ordered his book from the local bookstore. Her family lost their farm over 10 years ago, and Tiffany says in text today that she misses it dearly. So thank you for all of that input morning.
I'm glad you liked the segment, and Brian's book, you'll enjoy that. And Tiffany is watching The Secret Show.
She is.
Secret Show? We feel left out. Well, just
it's a
stream
secret.
It on YouTube. You get to see us. You get to hear us. And for better or worse, you get to hear us when everybody else is listening to
commercials
and whatnot.
And news and things. News. All of that's important, right,
Jamie,
but so are we.
Yes. Jamie, you're a lady.
Sure. Thank you for acknowledging that. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. In case people who can't see us, maybe they just think you're a man with a light voice.
There we go.
I have never used a filter on social media. So there's two questions here. When you post to social media, are you posting reality or are you posting some idealized version of your life that you want other people to believe? And I think this is especially a female problem on the internet. Why do ladies feel the pressure to use these filters to make themselves look different than they are? And I know that a lot, you can scroll through and you can automatically tell who's using a filter.
Well, and let's be real. This goes far beyond social media. This goes back years and years where we would see these images of women in magazines that have been totally touched
airbrushed. And even on TV where they shot women through cheesecloth to make sure they smoothed everything out.
Yes.
And you're like, Brian, with all that's going on, why would you bring this up? Because, well, it's the last segment and we always try to leave. And I thought this was odd and hilarious and very telling all at the same time.
Yeah.
Yes. So a beauty influencer in China lost 140,000 followers. Why? Did she say something controversial?
No.
Her filter glitched mid-live stream and revealed her natural face. And it wasn't like it revealed some horrible abomination of facial.
She's
wasn't
beautiful.
The elephant woman. Yes.
No, she's beautiful.
Yeah. But that was, yeah, 140,000 people went, I don't want to see the real you. I got to go.
Yeah, she was she's unnamed. And according to this viral footage, if you haven't seen it, she's filming herself dancing for the camera. She appears with this very porcelain-like complexion and these very perfect symmetrical features on a too small head is essentially what it looked like. Then the filter glitched and it dropped.
Why'd you call her a pinhead? That's mean.
And it revealed a much more natural appearance with a warmer skin tone. Shortly after that, the filter returned. It restored the more, we'll call it, stylized look. And then it kept flipping back and forth between the two looks, which was even crazier if you watch it. Now, of course,
yeah, that was weird.
This is where she started losing followers. Some have accused the influencer of deception. Others have rejected that framing. If you look at social media, questioning instead, like we are, why filters carry so much weight in the first place and why women feel the need to actually use them. I'll be honest. I will never use a filter. What you see is what you get. I don't even leave the house with a full face of makeup most days. I am completely natural in that respect.
That's another one of the double standards in this society. I never feel the need to look pretty.
Right.
I'll dress nice if I'm going to an event or something, but my face is my face. This is the one I got. You like it or you don't, whatever. My wife's happy with it, so that's all that matters. It's the fact that you have to say, I leave the house without a full face of makeup. I can't imagine. Parker, could you imagine having to get up in the morning looking at your Amish visage and saying, I've got to cover this up with pancake. I need my cat eyeliner on before I can leave the house. I'm going to the gym.
I look great as is, Brian. I'm not doing anything.
You are a handsome young man. Now, I will be honest. Even when I did wear makeup, it was always very light. I have never played personally into I need a lot of makeup in order to, I don't have that kind of time. I've done a lot of morning radio at 4 in the morning. I don't care. It is what it is.
Four in the morning.
but then during COVID is when I started adopting kind of a new routine for myself. And essentially it became, I just want to take care of my skin. I am going to age. I'm 48 years old. I'm okay with being 48 years old. I've been through a few things in life. And every wrinkle is, I'm okay with it. I'm okay with it. Even though I don't want to get older, I'm okay with the aging process.
And as far as social media goes, everybody gets older because the alternative sucks.
Yeah.
You either get older or you're dead. So you got to pick right there. I hate to be so blunt, but sometimes things are blunt. Tiffany jumps in. She says, societal pressures focus on how women look and what women do. America Ferrera's Barbie movie monologue comes to mind. Society expects women to be just so, but then get mad when a woman isn't honest.
Double standards.
We've all met a woman who looks one way at the bar and then she washes her face and you're like, ah, who are you? What happened? That's a goiter, isn't it?
Two-faced.
You're a Batman villain. What is your deal? All right. Well, that's it for today. We've got to go. The dogs need to go out. Yeah. You need a break.
We do.
So thank you for listening and being part of the show today.
It's 8:59. You are listening to Daybreak. This is the Civic Media Network. Have a fantastic day.
Bye.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.